Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the ISP Task Force at ONC. We will officially call the meeting to order, starting with roll call. Ken Kawamoto?
Here.
Stephen Lane?
Good morning.
Anil Jain?
I'm here.
Arian Malik? Okay. Andy Chestnut, I believe
here.
You said it was going to be late. Oh, is Andy on?
It's Terry, sorry.
Oh, okay. Clem McDonald?
Here.
Cynthia Fisher? Not yet. David McCallie? Not yet. Okay. Elville June?
Here.
Terry O'Malley?
Here.
Les Leonard? Jack Poe? Raj Watani?
Here.
Hi, Raj. Ram Charan? I thought I saw Ram on the Adobe. We'll circle back. Ricky Bloomfield? Not yet. Sasha Termot?
Here.
Scott Weingarten? Cheryl Turney? I guess I saw Cheryl on as well. Tamer for Calgary?
Here.
Hello. Tina Esposito? And Valerie Gray? Not yet. Okay. And Victor Lee?
Here.
Okay, great. I will turn it over to Ken and Stephen, our co-chairs.
Hey, Arian's here.
Oh, hi, Arian.
Well, good morning, everyone. I think Ken is still getting himself set up a little bit with his technology. So Ken, just let me know when you're all settled.
I am all settled.
But, excellent. Okay. Well, welcome everyone to our meeting. I appreciate everyone's time as always. And we can see that there are a number of additional participants who've dialed in today. So welcome to the public as well. We want to go through a little bit about the comments that we have received, just to reorient everyone. We are looking at priority uses of health information in response to priority areas that were identified in 21st Century Cures. We are going to be focusing in on the standards associated with those uses and where there may be opportunities for improvement, and we went through a process to organize some priority uses and use cases, and we did a balloting, and we prioritized the initial focus on the domain of orders and results. Within that, we have decided to focus initially on laboratory as well as on the resulting process, with the hope, though, that the insights that we gain would apply to other order domains, and that we could then back up our way into the ordering process. So what we did was we put up a chart or a spreadsheet, if you will, on the Google Drive that all of you have had a chance to contribute to. And I think what we wanted to do was just go through that and look at the general domains or the general problems that have been identified. I think a lot of people put some serious thought into this. I've actually gone through and tried to combine some of the information into individual rows so that everybody can see that. So we actually ended up, I think, with, 4 through 16, so about 12 different individual items that that we've called out. So we just wanted to kind of walk our way through that. And then we do have a number of guests with us today, specifically Brett Andreessen from the ONC, as well as Ken McCassin from Accenture and Virginia Sturmfels from Quest Diagnostics. These are all domain experts in the applicable standards. So we're going to be educated about the standards that exist, their state of evolution, and hear from the people who really work to maintain those standards so that we can start to go towards our next step, which is really identifying opportunities to advance the standards in support of these uses of health information that we've identified. So that's kind of just to bring everybody up to speed. Ken, do you want to add to that?
No, that sounds good. I think the idea is to use what people commented as a springboard for the discussion, so maybe not to go into too much detail at this point, but I think with the subject matter experts here, it'd be great to get their thoughts on some of these issues that the task force members thought were issues.
So somebody should share the spreadsheet from the Google Drive so that we can go through that kind of line by line.
Let's see, I can do it. See if I can find, here it is. Share. Is my Google Doc
showing? It looks great. Yeah, that's excellent. Coming through very nicely.
So maybe what we can do is go through these, but with the intention of going through it just to get the thoughts, but not necessarily to deep dive discuss them. For the folks who commented, maybe they can take their own comments for the most part, but with the request to go fairly expeditiously through these at this point. The first one was just from as a approach to doing this, all task force members had access to this editable Google Doc, and we asked for problem issue examples, associated standards and issues, if any, proposed remedies, and other notes and comments. Steve, I don't know if you want to take on this first one that was just from the general, and I think you had a lot of comments that you put on these as well.
Actually, those are not my comments. I've mostly been editing here. So
I think the big picture here was just not all results are available for patients to see. We have proposed remedies of expanding USCDI and making them available via Fire APIs from EHRs. And then there were other comments. And I guess one request would be, to the extent possible, if folks can maybe spell out their first name on these comments too. But said, not sure what the standard issues here, what result types are currently available, what's the blocker.
AM is Arian Malik, by the way. I apologize.
Perfect. And then SAT said there's also policy issues affecting this. Some states prohibit or have specific requirements for the electronic release of certain labs, including HIV tests. Subspatial alignment of state and federal policies in the space might further availability. I don't know if either Arian or SAT would like to comment on those before we move on.
Yeah, I just was confused.
Sasha.
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry, Sasha.
Oh, I was just going to say all the SAT comments for me.
Did you score well?
yeah.
I think these comments are pretty clear. Unless people have clarifications, I think then we can probably just go through. I think this will help everyone to orient to where our thinking has gone so far, and that I think especially our subject matter experts who are going to be helping us with the standards piece of it.
Sorry, I do think it would be useful if there's a perspective that some result types aren't available to the patient to enumerate what the result types are, so that we can address whether there is a standards issue, an underlying standards issue.
You want to comment on that, or just how are you going to go forward? Well, this is Clem. I don't know if I have my hands up that I can say something. But basically, it's not just the physicians. If they're not in a big hospital system, physicians also have the same problem, not just the patient. But the types that are generally are not specified to be available in detail in any of the guidance are EKGs, pulmonary functions, radiology text reports, and on and on. So most reports except for lab are not specified to be provided to anyone in a well-formed fashion. There's a little bit of stuff in CCDA that might hint they are required. So we're missing most clinical reports, and lab reports aren't complete.
And Clem, just to be really clear, so maybe we can dive into the labs are incomplete, but with respect to the other report types, for example, with respect to an EEG or with respect to an MRI, you're not looking at this point for the raw underlying data, the EEG waveform or what have you. You're looking for the interpretive report.
Correct. Okay. Structured or unstructured. And they're mixed. The cardiac X, about half are structured and half of them are narrative. But whatever they are, it gets sent out or could be sent out. That's what we should be doing.
Right. So maybe as a first approximation, there's a perspective. Because there are different standards. I'm only pointing this out because there are different standards issues. To a first approximation, there's a set of textual report types for which there's no corresponding consolidated CDA and US CDI support?
Well, that's maybe too strong. They aren't urged or clarified strongly in terms of coding.
Yeah, got it. That's the clarification I was looking for. Thank you.
They are actually by policy required.
Could you repeat that? I just couldn't hear.
Well, there's another comment. Someone was clarifying.
So this was Sasha.
I did not hear Clem's last point.
I'll repeat it, but there was maybe a clarification of my comment, which might should come first.
Sorry, this is Sasha. So Clem's point was that the radiology narratives are often missing as a result from a patient view. And I wanted to add that from a policy perspective, ONC 2015 edition certification does expect that the diagnostic imaging reports, the narrative component, would be made available to the patient.
But it's not well specified in any delivery mechanisms. It just says it should be made available, I believe. And maybe I'm wrong. So clarify, get me fixed if I'm wrong.
Clem, I think this is Cynthia Fisher. I think this is a really valid point because at least here in Massachusetts, you get a radiology image of an MRI. It's not ready that day. And the only person that can go back and get it has to drive back to the clinic and get it. They won't even transmit the radiology results, the descriptive. So it is absolutely onerous. And like, I think if we are very clear about once it's digitally available, that it needs to get pushed to the patient. You think about all the non-productive work time people are down just to try to gather this information.
Well, I'm absolutely for push, but I think we should distinguish between the image itself, which you can usually get on the way out with the DVD, but that's separate, and the report. Both are important. The report is easier, and we should make that a priority. I'm for both.
Agreed. And at what point do we also leave it open for the cloud to be able to provide transfer of the actual imaging itself, you know, with capacity in the cloud? So I just throw that, like, can we write it for the descriptive with as soon as, you know, possible as the technology available to transmit imaging as well? Because certain centers are linked to getting those images,
depends upon which network
you're in.
I think that's a good goal, but I think there's a whole horde of diagnostic studies that are not routinely reported with enough coding that you can store it on a receiving system. That's what I think we should be seeking, so that the patient could put it somewhere and find it, because it would be coded as being a radiology chest X-ray report or being an EEG report. Without that, you really can't do anything electronically with it in your own system.
And just as a point of order, we will have plenty of time for deep discussion. What we really want to do is do a initial high-level discussion of the points that were raised, and then since we have some guests who have thoughts that won't be on our future calls necessarily, we want to go to them. So if it's okay, let's sort of fairly quickly move through these with the notion that we'll discuss this in more detail with our SMEs. Terry, do you want to cover the ones that that you had commented on?
Sure, just sort of a broad overview. I kind of thought about these as, you know, are there standards to support the sender of the lab, the generator of the test? And are there standards to support the receiver of those results? And then are there standards that actually impact the results themselves? But I kind of broke it into three pieces, whether those are the right three pieces or not, but that's what we did. So these are issues that come up. Go ahead, Clem. Sorry.
Can you make the slide bigger? It's just hard to see the words on the.
Yes, okay. I can. Sorry, I'm on a big screen. Let's make it. Is that better? It'll just skip the comments, but I can scoot over there.
It's better.
Okay. Great.
And then my comments are really just on issues that I face daily taking care of patients. They're just the first couple that came to mind.
Okay. So big picture was not all results available for clinicians, not all results can be used for clinical distance support, getting too many lab results of low value, can't send, receive a series of trended results. Okay. Terry, anything else to add with these before moving on to the next ones? And again, we'll come to these back to these with more detail later.
Nope, thanks.
Okay, I'll go on next to mine. This is a set that I'm coming to. I think it's pretty similar to what Terry had noted. So the first issue was that a fair amount of lab results are not encoded with appropriate LOIN codes or the expected units, and you know they may also be missing units altogether. Is just something, and I'm going to just for this, it's somehow not showing, so I'm going to zoom out a little bit. I'll zoom back in once it's past this part. So the issue with this means that things that require this kind of semantics make it difficult. So for example, one thing Terry mentioned was trending similar labs with each other, or clinical distance support, or deduplication, making it so you only see the things that are relevant. All these require these semantics. So when you don't have it, you can't do this. And the result is you have incomplete decision-making.
That can't be overemphasized because people don't realize that just getting the report without the right semantics, you can't do much of anything with it. You can't find the last result to compare with the previous one, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, no. So this is an issue we face on a routine basis. So agreed. I mean, without semantics, the data, the usefulness goes way down. Obviously, you know, even just free text is useful, but there's a lot that you want to do beyond it. And this is where I may have a myopic view, but some of the source of this issue might include the smaller labs, including hospital labs, don't LOINC encode their labs or not doing it to the extent needed. And then we also find that there's a decent amount of manual entry of labs in our EHRs. For example, for outside labs that aren't interfaced in or point of care labs. In that case, for example, it's fairly common for a user to not enter units, for example, or to choose the wrong one, or you know, or for that concept to not be encoded. So this, you know, it's not a 10% issue in our experience, but it can be a 5% issue. And you know, if you're willing to accept 5% error rates, it's not an issue. But if you're not, then it's a problem. So I'll go into this a little bit in the sense in terms of proposed remedies because it's basically repeated for all mine, and I can skip it after this one, but. The main one, I think, minimum, and some EHR vendors already do this, so it's not saying necessarily something new, but I think EHR should provide a mechanism that allows clients to properly map internal lab codes to LOIN codes when they're missing. And then there's a whole bunch of other potential solutions, but one big one might be to just say, hey, let's allow for this kind of let's prioritize which ones need to be accurately semantically mapped and actually get it done as a community. With the key part being prioritization, because you know, just in our institution, we have like 4,000 labs in our
that can be resulted. And, you know, a third are never used or only ordered like less than 5 times a year. And do we really want to focus on those when, you know, it's a Pareto kind of principle where there's a lot more that are ordered a lot more frequently in terms of volume. Let's see, I'm just going to go on to some of the other ones so that I don't take too much time. Another one was results and observations outside of lab tests are not interoperably shared. So this is pretty similar to the others, so I won't go into too much detail. And there's a question of whether we want to include these in scope, but obviously there's a lot of what you would consider observations that are outside labs that are pain points for sharing, like gestational age or Glasgow Coma score or pain assessment results or phototherapy administration times, imaging results, echo results, et cetera. So I won't go into this in too much detail other than to say this is a big point of pain. And I'll just note that in some EHR systems, it's required that observations are LOINC encoded elements, even if they're like non-lab codes. It's just the way it's supported. And what that poses the obvious challenge of, well, what if there isn't a LOINC code for what you want to express? What do you do then? Especially as LOINC, I believe, don't allow local extensions. So you basically have to go through not only seeking LOINC itself to be extended, but then for the change management process that usually takes some time, at least in our health system, of that actually getting incorporated and pushed out and, you know, being adopted into the system. Another one is it's so often important to know what has been ordered and what the status is. So this is important, especially if you're recommending something. So if you're recommending that something be done, like a user is going to be very annoyed if you say, hey, you should order a pulmonary rehab referral or, you know, you should order, you know, home oxygen. And they say, well, I ordered it, you know, 15 minutes ago. How come you don't know that I've already done it? Like, I'm going to ignore this from now on. So this is not really well supported right now, I think, in what's currently available and in a standard form, ideally. I think whereas things like meds, labs, and lab results are already well encoded and things like conditions, things like orderables currently aren't very well mapped to standards or even searchable using standards. Related to this is the lack of standard order catalogs, which is an issue. And I'll just note the challenge here probably is the biggest challenge here is that oftentimes in orderables you want metadata other than just the code, quote unquote, of the order. Like, you know, do you want it stat? Do you want it, you know, for a future date? If so, what date? You know, those kinds of things that you oftentimes want to prepackage in a orderable. So there's some issues there. And then those were mine. And then David McCauley had a number of comments. I don't think he's on. He said he was going to be on PTO in an area with poor cell reception. David is not on yet, is he? I don't think he was. Okay. Stephen, do you want to go through these, or do you want me to?
Well, again, I think they're pretty, self-explanatory. I mean, again, the key issue about the integration of external clinical decision support, I think, is a key issue that a number of us have discussed. The next one, I think, may be a bit duplicative, and we may be able to combine these comments and some of the above discussions regarding results delivery, both to providers and patients, that we have mentioned the challenge of prior authorization and what are the standards that can be used to manage that step in the ordering process. And David also re-raised the issue that Clem has been so stalwart in bringing forward, is the issue of imaging results. Both the textual report as well as getting access to the images themselves. And David gave us a lot of detail about some of the players in that field. So, and again, what you can see we've done here is we're trying to kind of boil these down into the key issues. I think we can still do some more of that. This relates very much to the other work that we've done in terms of identifying the steps in the order and resulting process. And then I see one hand up from Ricky, so maybe we can take Ricky's comment and any others before we transition over to the discussion of the standards that apply here. Ricky, you want to go ahead?
Sure, yeah, this was a while back, but just related to the item of uncoded lab values, and I think it relates to some of the other points that came up, and that's just that it would be helpful to have some hard data on which items aren't coded, if it's possible to get some reports from representative health systems and EHR vendors that might help inform the discussion and prioritization. And I think that relates to some of the others as well.
Good point. I'll note it.
And then Clem, your hand is up.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the issue isn't as much the availability or the existence of a given standard for a given area, although there are some that probably need to be embellished, but it's that there's not push or enforcement or regulation or encouragement at the level necessary. So the commercial labs mostly all provide line codes because they are incented, I think, by the insurance companies principally, but the little labs don't. And I think if we could get on or CMS to do the right incentive, it would solve itself in a year.
Yeah, and I think part of the issue.
Go ahead.
No, I think there's always the issue of what to do also when there's manual data entry. And I think it'd be useful to get some quantification on it. We found it's a non-trivial issue, at least when we're trying to reach something like a 98% accuracy.
Yeah, as a suggestion to the task force, it might be helpful to classify issues where standards are appropriate but aren't being sufficiently widely used, areas where standards are there but are inadequate, and areas where standards are missing, and maybe to use the to some extent and Empower team, chaired by Dixie Baker, put together a really nice framework for assessing standards maturity, and so we might need to reach into that. But I think as a first approximation, we're going to discover that a lot of these issues are issues of the standard, like LOINC and the LRI exist, are perfectly sufficient, but aren't widely adopted. And that's a very different kind of problem from lack of standards availability. So I think as we go through this, being thoughtful about this and classifying this appropriately might be useful.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we've gotten through the comments. We are at the half hour, which is just about where we wanted to be. And I think what we'd like to do, we talked to Brett Andreessen yesterday about walking us through the standards that are applicable in this area. And then, as we said, we've invited some additional subject matter experts who are helping to manage the standards themselves. And I think, Brett, you had a pretty clear approach as to how you were going to do that. I'm not sure why we're looking at this agenda from July, but I don't think that's the document that we need. There, thanks. Brett, do you want to sort of start us off?
Sure. So I don't know if I should be sharing my screen or I can pass links to other folks who can. I was just going to walk folks through kind of what is on a number of the interoperability standards advisory pages that kind of relate to lab orders, results, and lab tests, and kind of just orient folks to what's there in the ISA, and then, you know, pass it over to Virginia and Ken to maybe dig a little bit deeper into, you know, the underlying standards that are listed here, and then give folks the chance to chat about each one.
Brett, because you probably know the ISA better than anyone, if you wanted to share your screen and kind of walk us through that and give us a little bit of a tour, if you will, of where things are. And because I think our goal is for the task force members and the public to be able to get comfortable with this resource. And I'll just put in a plug that it is currently open for public comment through the end of this month. and the for an annual update. So I think this is a great opportunity for people to understand what's there, and for us as a group and as a community to identify opportunities to improve on it.
Sure. I'm not sure how to share my screen in the Adobe Connect.
I think somebody
can figure that out.
Let's just go to the first link for
or someone can go to the link, and I can talk it through. That's fine too.
I think you should be able to present now.
There we go. All right, folks should be able to see the ISA page. Can you?
We've got it. Perfect.
All right, and hopefully the size is okay. So here, this is in section one for representing laboratory tests. We have a standard for observations that is blank here, and then a standard for observation values. That's SNOMED. That's kind of a pairing we see a lot throughout section one. Both are in final status, both should really be in production here, but I think we recently added the observation values, so wanted to get some feedback from folks on adoption level and implementation maturity, but both are federally required, free. We also have kind of a list of applicable value sets and starter sets here from LOINC, which includes the top 2,000 plus lab observations, and I'll link directly to that. And then kind of a host of information that folks have asked us to provide around LOINC and how that works within LabTest.
Brett, I see under the standard for observations, LOINC, the adoption level is flagged as 3 out of 5. Can you say more about that?
Sure. So in terms of adoption level, we don't really have a strong scientific data collection really for the adoption level component. It really is kind of our best guess based on kind of what we're hearing from industry and based on public comments we receive. We sometimes have a little bit more insight in some versus others, but really that's kind of our gut check of kind of where we think it is. And certainly, you know, if we get comments that it should be higher or lower, we do take those and consider them. But we don't have like a strong current way of measuring that and collecting that information. So we provide it because we think it's helpful to provide some level of detail there, but it's certainly not the most scientific.
Hey, this is Arian. We've done in previous FACA incarnations, we've done slightly more quantitative work here. I agree with Ricky that, for example, going to one of the cloud EHR vendors that may be able to quickly pull percent of labs that are and are not LOINC encoded would be incredibly useful. The general trends here are that the national commercial labs are able to LOINC encode, that the large, particularly academic hospitals, are able to LOINC encode, and that the issue occurs the smaller down the rank you go, whether that be a community lab or a smaller hospital system that may not be able to go through the time and complexity it requires to completely recode their lab systems. And the trends are favorable, but that long tail is fairly slow.
Another question, Brett. Under SNOMED, we just lost it, but it's listed here as implementation maturity feedback requested. What is it about the use of SNOMED for the observation values that is that is less mature than the use of LOINC for the observations themselves.
I mean, my assumption this is that simply like there's actually relatively little that's SNOMED encoded for observation values, right? So this is not for like, you know, lab results that are like 3.5 milligrams per deciliter. Like you wouldn't use SNOMED CT for that, right? I mean, this is for things like, hey, you did this assessment and the result is the, you know, it was, you know, the patient entered this classification category from this assessment, which tends to show up in free text. I think that's what it's referring to, although it says it's representing lab tests.
I could comment on that. I mean, so
yeah.
at least 90%, maybe 95% of lab test results are numeric, so it doesn't apply. It's for the categorical test results, like high, low, you know, reactive, non-reactive, is where and for bacterial names that it's really being important for. And I think it's required for reporting to CDC, for communicable disease reporting, and it is supported there, but it's done as sort of a handwork by the lab sending specially to those areas.
My assumption is the adoption level for this is actually like 1 out of 5, maybe. I don't know.
I'm sorry. The other problem is the labs tend to want to be expressive in their research. Although say no evidence for mycobacteria, Kansasia, bacteria, you know, it goes on and on. And those are not the kind of things SNOMED likes to have.
Yeah. Yeah, it's obviously an issue, but I don't know.
Do we want to go to the next set of standards?
Well, I thought, Brett, that you had mentioned that with your introduction, we were then going to turn to Ken and or Virginia to provide some perspective from deeper down inside these code sets. Do we have, I see Virginia on the web meeting. I don't see Ken. Oh, yeah, now I see. Now I see Ken. I see you both. So, would you guys like to comment? Hopefully you've been listening to this whole discussion for the last 40 minutes and can educate us further about the state of these standards.
Sure. This is Virginia. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. We have a little bit of a presentation, Ken and I. Farah, if you could display, that would be great.
Go on to the next one, and then the next slide, and then it'll start there. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's start from there. Ken, are you on? You hear me?
Yes, Ken's here. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Excellent.
Okay. So Ken and I work for Quest Diagnostics. I'm the manager of medical licensure and regulation for Quest. And Ken, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Ken McCaslin, Accenture. I'm a senior manager in the health and public services. I'm also the co-chair of orders and observations at HL7, and I serve on the technical steering committee at HL7.
So going back 4 or 5 years ago, both Ken and I acted as co-chairpersons on some of the implementation guide work groups. Specifically, I worked on vocabulary area and LRI. So we wanted to thank you for moving the slides forward. And I do want to say I was listening intently. I love the comments that were initially stated in the beginning of this call I thought that it shows a real experience with the use of these implementation guides, and specifically vocabulary. It shows maturity and some further thought on how these can certainly move forward in the future. I also have some thoughts about SNOMED and why the adoption level isn't quite so high, and we can talk about that in just a moment. But I did want to discuss that, you know, that we did create at the time three different implementation guides represented here as EDOS, LOI, and LRI. They're each different, they're independent, and they provide a service in amongst themselves. This defined, of course, the functionality that was to occur between an EHR and the reference laboratory. So previously, we didn't have a lot of guidance in this area, and we had, although these guides are based on the HL7 version 2.5.1, the 2.5.1 version itself did not create a lot of instruction for the conversations and interfaces between EHRs and laboratories. However, the IGs were developed to constrain this information and the data that's in an HL7 message to the clinical interfaces. And so, like I said, these guides were developed to provide the foundation for an interoperable solution. We have the EDOS, which is a test compendium provided by the laboratory, which has identified all the components of the test, the requirements for the testing, and the requirements for the identifiers to be used in the message. The LOI we developed here also is the laboratory order message from the ordering provider that gathers the appropriate information that we need that needs to get submitted to the laboratory to in order to perform the testing, and this information is provided based on the requirements of EDOS. And the LRI is the laboratory result message, which is consistent with the requirements of the LOI and EDOS and can provide the results back to the EHR. What we were able to do and show in these profiles is that the profile constrained the contents of the fields. So we were identifying specific data sets to be used, such as the vocabulary data sets that should be used in each of the results that we're reporting back. We were talking before about the importance of the semantics that's used to create interoperability. We worked with defining what link subset should be used. We talked about SNOMED. And again, I think the implementation of SNOMED we see is not as great as what we had hoped or anticipated due to the individuals that need to do the mapping of the SNOMED code. I think is we may not have as many individuals or SMEs out there who are also capable of doing the SNOMED coding. Also, as Clem, I think you pointed out, there's the negation factor there. And the LOINC mapping, there was one person made a comment about that in the EHR system, maybe the LOINC mapping could be installed there. Just want to make a caveat from the laboratory perspective that LOINC codes are to be assigned by the laboratory based on their best knowledge of the testing that's being performed. So if there was a LOINC mapping provided into an EHR system, we would expect that it would be something that was approved by the laboratory performing the test. And of course, we talk about other laboratory and standards, vocabulary standards, such as the inclusion of ICD-9 codes and UCOM. There was some limited discussion about including UCOM at the time that the LRI was published. I just also want to say that what was helpful was the fact that these guides, the implementation guides, were produced and created by a cross-functional group of folks. You know, we had people from the EHR systems, from Epic helped us. We had people from, you know, CDC. We had the laboratories involved, the commercial laboratories, tried to get some of the reference laboratories involved. And so we wanted to kind of share that that knowledge was collected and decisions made by a cross-functional team. Also, these profiles can be grouped together to improve the constraints of the 251 message. We want to make sure that information is gathered together. We can use it to define sometimes the date and time, make things more specific where needed, date and time being a field that is sometimes doesn't need to be very specific, but and can be more broad, but sometimes we definitely need time, collection, for example, collection time down to minutes or seconds. Also, these profile were can be decided upon through conformance statements. So this would be from between the sender and the receiver. There is agreement upon what's going to be sent and received, and that can also help to constrain the message. And then also we know that there are needs to be profiles for based on the patient's criteria or the type of care that's being performed and testing being ordered. And this could be example of newborn screening where we need to have special information. So this can be an agreement to have AOE questions asked. These are the observations that the laboratory needs to ensure that both the testing is accurately performed and results provided that are can be interpreted along with these observations. There was a mention before about gestational age. Of course, this type of information does come to the laboratory through AOE questions, which can be coded, by the way. Just in summary, the constraints
just one insertion. I don't know if you said AOE is ask at order entry. I don't know if people know that acronym. That's why I thought you ought to say it.
Oh, thanks, Clem. Yes, ask at order entry questions. Yes, they're important to the laboratory. And then on the right-hand side, we just really summarized the constraints because we think that these are important. They drive the message behaviors. We are able to enforce conformance between the parties by these agreements that are set up between the lab and the EHR systems, and also define some testable outcomes, which we are going to talk about a little bit further down this presentation. So these are the constraints that are we feel are important to maintain with these guides.
Apologies. Sorry, this is Arian. Just apologies if you already have this, but can you comment on the inclusion of these implementation guides in existing certification criteria? My belief is that LRI and LOINC are required of EHRs both at from an incorporate perspective, from a receipt and incorporate perspective, and for the subset of labs that are attached to an EHR, there's an existing certification criterion for the send, but it's not universally required. So maybe you can correct my perspective there, or if Sasha or somebody from the ONC can.
I'll just start off because I do want someone else to comment on current behavior. But you're right. When the IGs came out, we didn't recognize immediately the need for this testable outcomes. And this is where quickly NIST was able, I think, to step in and assist in determining certification of the use of the LRI required guides from the implementation guide and those profiles. Can someone else comment on current certification?
Well, this is Clem. Those things, the LRI or the V, I think it's V5.2, was included in the draft notice of proposed rulemaking, but it was taken out of the final one in 2015 or whatever that year was.
Well,
yeah, but it's also true that the links required inside the computer system, so there's both of the statements I heard are true, but that specific specification was not imposed because they retracted it, and someone else from ANC might be able to be more clear.
Receipt is definitely required, but yeah, we should make sure that ONC provides the current summary of certification requirements in this area. And I think it's
this is Sasha. I stuck a link in the chat too, but there was actually some evolution between the 2014 edition and the 2015 edition in the lab criteria that were specified because of the removal of the measure of incorporation of lab test results from the meaningful use program.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some of the standards were specified in the 2014 edition and consequently likely have widespread adoption, even though they were removed in the 2015 edition and no longer listed.
Right.
That's right. They were removed because they were topped out, because we actually had fairly universal ability to incorporate, and they were being reported out in meaningful use at very high levels.
Could I just clarify on that? There was a letter from some major libraries that disputed the widespread use question, and LabCorp, a major person in LabCorp sent a letter that did not agree with that interpretation and the removal.
Yes, I say it got topped out. Exactly. It would be interesting to see if anyone is still, you know, obtaining the certification through submitting LRI, using the LRI specs.
Excuse me. This is Stephen Lane. I'm sensitive to the time. I know that you have a substantial additional material that you're going to present, and I see that Terry O'Malley has a hand up, and there may be others who have questions, but let's let you get through your presentation and then maybe take questions at the end.
Thank you. Next slide, please, Farah.
So the next slide is slide 3, and unfortunately I lost my connection to you guys, so I'm assuming you're seeing the approach to the flexible guide.
Yes.
And to a conversation that we heard earlier, results are not appearing in places, and I would suggest that part of the reason is that we're not driving the behavior based on an order message. Lots of data is collected as the EHR sends an order to the lab so that we can connect the order to the results correctly within the EHR. And we're trying to make sure that we capture the information in a way that makes sure that we have a good relationship not only to the EHR, but also to that patient record within the EHR. So the laboratory on the order can capture that. And that might solve some of that interoperability problems if we enforce better behavior around the laboratory receiving electronic order. As best as people can, they type in patient identifiers, and we know that there's a high incidence of errors in that. The other thing is that with the basic lab message, we are putting constraints based on profiles, and as you add additional profiles, they constrain things further. And in this particular guide, what we did was we took the data types and we actually add flavors to them. And Virginia had talked very briefly about newborn screening, where there's additional criteria we need to not only capture on the front end, but we also have to capture a more precise date of birth and when the collection was done, because there's normal ranges that are unique to every moment in that newborn's life. And so if you look at the top of the screen, you'll see I put it in yellow, newborn screen requirements. You add that in as a profile constraint because now you're saying I need more detail around date information. And then that can pop out because you're dealing with adults. So there are some profile that have constraints that are only there for a particular care episode. So within these different profiles, there are things where if a laboratory can handle a universal identifier, which in HL7 terms is an OID, we can create a profile where that happens. But a lot of the partners were identifying that they could not do a universal identifier, and so we gave them the option so that as people are able to get more sophisticated in their interoperability, there were profiles that would manage that kind of sophistication. So that's the way that we've structured the guides so that the basic interface will work consistently the same. And as you develop your ability to manage better quality of information, then you can add in the additional profiles and make sure your partners can do that. And as Virginia had mentioned, we had an evolutionary process that happened because initially when we were trying to put conformance statements in, we discovered that we weren't making those statements operable. And so we ended up having to re-engineer the way we did conformance statements so that we could actually test them. So we had NIST involved helping us put the correct terminology in place so that it could be put in a rules engine and actually drive better behavior. So I'm going to jump over to the next slide, which says example of constraints of profile construction. So newborn screening is a clear example of that. Time zone offsets. Some people were not doing the time zone offsets, and in a lot of cases, it does not make a difference. But when you're dealing with newborn screening, you do need to know the time offset, particularly if you go across barriers, time zone barriers. I talked a little bit about identifiers. So you have people who can support OIDs, the global identifier, and you have people who could not support OIDs. So we have a profile that manages both. And I'm going to turn it back over to Virginia. I'm going to end up getting kicked out of this conference room in 2 minutes, probably. So I'll have to drop offline.
Okay. Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it. Farrell, one last slide. It's really a summary slide, so we can get into more discussion. Okay. So these are just shows outcomes from the development of the IGs. Again, we talked about what stage. It's very important that the EDOS is shown first or provided first with the framework for the requirements for the performing laboratory as they define it, that the EDOS then creates the parameters for the LOI, which then drives the LRI reporting process. So the inclusion and the thoughtfulness needs to, for anything going forward, needs to be thought of for in each of those IGs, and that the IGs conform to each other. They provide guidance on the conformance between the partners, the EHRs, the EMRs, and the laboratory interfaces. They provide a path, hopefully, these constraints, so we don't have to actually re-engineer an interface, but it can be configured appropriately.
Virginia, I think that's a great point, because one of the things that I heard was the results are not appearing. So in some interfaces, just because the lab is sending the LOINT code doesn't mean that the EHR is actually capturing the LOINT code and putting it into their patient record. So that may be the problem with the downstream effect. And the this particular group of implementation guides actually have conformance requirements that not only do you receive the data, but you actually make it available. So that's also a conformance criteria. Sorry, Virginia.
No, thank you. Great point. And then the last one was just, as we talked about, that we want to have testable outcomes. And so the discussion about certification of these interfaces and moving forward to make sure they're in compliance. So I think that's the last slide. So Ken and I want to thank you for the opportunity to join you today. Great discussion. We'd love to try to be included going forward. I can especially speak for the commercial reference laboratories. We definitely want to be here to support.
Well, and thank you so much. Before we lose Ken, hopefully, I just wanted to kind of lay out what I see as our biggest challenges here, and that is there's been a lot of discussion within our task force about not only the importance of moving results between laboratories and the providers, both the ordering and CC and others downstream, but also to help. So all of this references lab to EHR EMR, but not so much lab to PHR or to patient receiving this information via perhaps a direct address or unsecured email, et cetera. Has any work in this space been done looking specifically at making these results more available to and useful for patients?
So I can speak for on the commercial reference laboratory side. We certainly make results available. We have specific customer identified reports so that the reporting is to the customer or the patient different. It's not necessarily going through the EHR when they make the request directly from the laboratory. We have an app called MyQuest, for example, that you go on, you register, and you see results, but they're in a more customer, can be viewed in a more customer-friendly way. You know, vocabulary standards are not, Link and SNOMED are not presented. There's also usually some insights which are provided with those types of patient reports that are going directly from the laboratory. Now, I can't speak for EHR systems, what kind of reporting that they might have to the patient. If that's where you draw, I hope I understood the question correctly.
Hey, Virginia,
yeah,
it also might be worthwhile, since there was some comment on ancillary clinicians, the support of LRI for copy 2 providers.
So within the interface, we do provide the documentation of who the copy twos are, and we do provide that information in a structured way with the intent that we can send it if the laboratories know who these people are. But there are situations where there may be a new physician and they may not be able to identify that physician.
I think the other big area that I think we're going to want to work with you on is really understanding what are the opportunities for us to support moving this forward. I think that what we've heard in our conversations from many sources is that while these standards exist, that they are incompletely implemented or inadequately constrained. That you guys have done tremendous work putting this together, but that, as you've said, not all the EHRs can receive all of the key metadata elements, that they may not maintain them, and that may impact their ability to then subsequently share the data. I think that this focus has really been on the order from the provider to the lab, the result from the lab to the provider, but what we're dealing with is both this, you know, downstream delivery to the patient or their proxy, but also the ability for the initial receiving provider to then share that data with all of the associated metadata so that it can then be interoperated between systems. With regard to the work that you've done, has that been a consideration, that requirement to maintain and then subsequently share the metadata when the data moves on beyond the initial recipient?
Yeah, I think that needs to be more fully discussed and developed. I don't think that that we have, other than a copy to type situation, that we've addressed that fully enough.
Hi, this is Cynthia.
Yeah. I was just saying, I will bring that back to our member laboratories and make sure that, you know, I am correctly stating that.
I want to thank both of you for your input to the task force. It's been very, very helpful. And I come into the task force from a layman representing, looking at it from a patient, a family, a caregiver's point of view. And at 30,000 feet, looking at what's relevant to the patient in getting these results, one, timely, and two, that they can provide it then to a specialist or back to their care provider. An interesting case in point from a practical standpoint, having just had a healthy 22-year-old get a blood test at the Brigham and Women's. And I'm looking to you all to also look at connecting to the patient the delivery of the actual conformity encoding, because the Brigham's did a standard blood test, which I happen to have been 25 years in the blood industry, so I know the costs and the types of tests that are done and the machine capabilities. But we had, out of a healthy 22-year-old, a blood analysis result sent to us first of a bill of $4,300, of which our self-insured Blue Cross administered to pay $2,200 and give us a $700 draw. And the results were a standard blood test, unremarkable. That said, my next pursuit was to go to Quest and to go to LabCorp and get competitive pricing for the same blood tests, which you can imagine are substantially lower by a tenth of the cost at list price. Now I'm trying to get the negotiated price, but what I noted was the coding of the exact testing was different. So trying to compare apples to apples and then prevent this this type of billing in future blood analysis of a healthy 22-year-old, and to be able to articulate a discrepancy by a factor of 1,000. So as from a patient standpoint, it'd be very helpful if we looked at, one, providing a link of what a commonality of coding, two, that we could compare apples to apples and know that patients will be getting involved in price handling, because otherwise, you know, these types of charges are going to bankrupt our economy. So I just kind of put that toward our task force, laying the groundwork for that future. And then finally, what would be helpful if, you know, someone has rhabdo and you got to look at their blood analytics over time, just make sure everything's back to normal, is that you're able to basically do data analytics in a machine-readable form, so you can plot any discrepancies and chart over time.
Ken and Clem, this is Ken McCaslin again. I believe that CME actually would help with that issue. Would you guys agree with that? That's a new standard around conformance regarding criteria of what should be included in a particular package.
I guess theoretically it could, but thing that CME could support it is equivalent to saying things like, you know, a conformance profile or a fire profile could. So I think CME or any other approach for constraining could work. I think CME certainly could.
Clem, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I was going to comment on an earlier statement about getting the data to the patient, because two of my employees came in excitedly showing me the Apple Health application that they get and the data they get from their hospitals. And they can push a button, and you can see the link codes, and you can see all the structure underneath the JSON, or you can see it in text. So I think, you know, Apple Health, and I think things that will evolve along the same line, are solving the patient getting the data problem.
Go, Ricky.
Already.
Sorry, I had my hands up, so I just want to make sure you all know that I've got.
Yeah, go ahead, Arian.
Okay. So just a little history lesson, and I think it's instructive for the task force. This is a little bit of welcome to my world. The LRI guide was kicked off based on, during my time at ONC, when I was coordinating standards and interoperability framework, and Jitna Znani led the work from an ONC coordination perspective. It was a joint effort between ONC with some funding and the lab community that Virginia and Ken are representing. And that was done in 2011. The LOI, the lab orders interface, was done subsequent to that, I believe in 2012. So these guides have been out and available, and I think you're going to find that there's a fair amount of specification and detail behind both the LRI and the LOI, and that we're in an area. So I think sometimes the perspective is that clinicians in the field, I think the perspective of this task force has been really wonderfully clinically weighted. Perspective in the field is that the clinical outcome is falling short of what the goal is, and that therefore there must be a standards problem. I think we're going to find that the majority of the issue here is, you know, there may be additional standards and standards development that's necessary. I think we've noted things like creating hierarchies between link codes so that similar analytes can be compared. That kind of work is incredibly useful. I think in this area, what we're going to find is that the standards are sufficient, but either A, inadequately supported in practice, and we should distinguish between inadequately supported in practice on the sending side versus on the receiving side, and in particular because the oversight mechanisms and the regulatory mechanisms are very different. CLIA regulates labs from an HHS CMS perspective. CAP also has certification oversight for labs, and in many cases EHR certification just doesn't, it's not the appropriate policy lever. And I think we've, in other areas, we may have the technical means to incorporate LRI, but as I think we've heard in practice, that may not be supported end-to-end from a user experience and a data flow perspective. So it's important to distinguish areas where we've got an underlying standards problem, and then areas where the standards are, and you know, I think we've noted LRI, the ability to support CopyTo, the ability to support Firebase API access when the labs are incorporated in order to provide access to the patient. I think we've got the mechanisms in place from a standards and certification criteria. There may be some incremental efforts, but then I think we're going to find we're still going to have gaps in practice, and that really is a different set of issues, and it's a, you know, what are the hooks to make sure that those standards are more appropriately supported in practice, and whether those hooks are regulatory or whether they're, frankly, the EHRs and the lab community getting together and doing another turn of the crank on the end-to-end user experience, you know, might be an appropriate mechanism. So, again, just a warning that we not jump from you know, we're not getting clinical outcome to, therefore, we have a standards problem. In many cases, the standards are actually, we've actually done a ton of work on the standards, and what we have is really an ecosystem problem. So, thanks.
Arian, thank you for those comments. And I think that, and again, while we still have Ken and Virginia and everyone else here, I think that we want to reiterate that what we've discussed as a work group, and we didn't reiterate it earlier, is the concept of making the requirement to adhere to these standards a prerequisite for labs getting paid to do this work, basically really forcing compliance with the standards through the payment mechanism. And obviously, there can be all sorts of unintended consequences to that. But I'd be curious, from Virginia and Ken's perspective, if we made this a condition of participation that all of these this metadata was both sent to the ordering provider system and ECC provider systems and maintained by those systems and then subsequently utilized for ongoing interoperability, and/or if we made it a requirement that these results and their associated metadata were made available to patients or individuals as part of the process. What do you see as the potential risks of moving in that direction or unintended consequences that we should consider?
Jenny, you want to take the lead?
Well, sure. So I don't really want to, I don't see the value necessarily in, these are tough questions, on trying to make this metadata necessarily available or make the claim submission and payment any more complicated than it currently is. So, you know, we have standards that seem to be able to identify what is performed and should be paid for. I am potentially in favor of this metadata and availability potentially to patients. We, as I described before, we have a patient-friendly version of our reports at this point in time, which is what we would normally give over to patients. And we did develop these reports, and I'm sure the other labs had the same experience, without really much guidance out there on what is a patient-friendly, consumer-friendly report, and what should it contain? And should there be the opportunity for the patient to also receive a report that contains additional information and data, as you're suggesting? That is certainly something that needs to be explored. I don't know. Ken, do you have any thoughts, please?
Wow, there are so many different in the LOINC standard, there's so many different statements that are in there. I wonder if that's a LOINC community opportunity to provide an additional field in LOINC that says this will help the patient understand the data. Would that make sense?
Good idea.
Yeah.
It just amplify that a bit more, Ken.
I think we already need to identify the analyte with a LOINC code so that we have that universal relationship. And then when you say, I'm bringing that data into a PDR, then rather than bring the technical information in, let's bring in that patient-centric information and make it universal so that regardless which laboratory you're engaged with, everybody would have that patient, the same patient descriptions, and make it patient friendly. Is that's sort of what I'm thinking? Clem,
it's a really interesting comment because it sounds like, you know, the labs now with developing patient portals are kind of where the provider and the HR community was some years ago, where there's a high degree of paternalism and a desire to sort of make this information safe and palatable for the patient. But what we just heard from Clem, and I think we've heard that from others, is the patients just want it all. You know, they don't want anyone being too worried about protecting them. You know, when Apple shows the results, they see the results and they can get to the metadata all the way down. And I think that what we're hearing from our community and our stakeholders here on the task force is a desire to make all of this much more transparent and to keep the metadata with the results. So,
To be fair to the lab, to Quest and LabCorp and other lab, major labs, I think the notion of direct to consumer has been an area that the commercial labs have been advocating for a long time. To be frank, a lot of the opposition has come from the physician community. And in many areas, that opposition is enshrined in state law that expressly forbids labs from being released to patients on a direct-to-consumer basis because of the fear that providing access to lab data without clinical interpretation would provide major harm to the patient. So I think in some areas, we may have some policy preferences that are going to run afoul of state regulation. that actually forbid the kind of data flows that we're looking for. I just want to be fair to the lab vendors, the national labs, that I actually think national labs have been on the forefront of trying to make data available to patients, and in many cases the opposition has been from their critical stakeholders, which are the physicians who are doing most of the ordering.
So is
there
we're
going to cut off the comments for now. Cynthia, just hold tight, because it is time for us to go to public comments, and we want to do that in a timely manner, and then we'll come back for additional comments. Please raise your hands so we can get back to everyone in turn. Shall we go to public comment?
Sure. Thanks, Stephen. Operator, can you please open the public line?
Yes, thank you. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad, and a confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Great, thanks. And I just want to circle back to roll call from earlier. I believe I've captured Andy Trescott and Les Leonard. Is there anyone else who didn't announce themselves during roll at the top of the call?
This is Cheryl Turney. I did respond that you didn't hear me, and I also put it in the chat.
Yes, I got you, Cheryl. Anyone else?
This is Cynthia Fisher.
I am
here as well.
So that was Cynthia and Jack. Anyone else?
Yep.
Okay, great. Operator, do we have any comments in the queue at this time?
There are no comments at this time.
Okay. Thank you. I'll turn it back to Stephen to finish up with the comments.
Great. Thank you. And again, we just, for task force members, we really want to be respectful of the role of the public in the meeting. So appreciate your patience. So Cynthia, I know you don't seem to be able to raise your hand. So why don't you go ahead and make your comments?
Yes. I just wanted to follow up on Aaron's comment regarding direct-to-consumer and the public. For awareness, just since 1992, the umbilical cord blood banking world has actually delivered direct-to-consumer the results of both the mother's infectious disease as well as the analytics on the child's cord blood. And there's, you know, now over decades of and millions, probably about 4 million cord blood results that have been provided direct to the consumer in 50 states. So if we would want to pursue anything there, I have not known in that industry any problems, and in fact, it's been very well received by the consumers.
Thank you. I noticed that most of the hands have come down, but Sasha, if you're still with us, I wanted to circle back to you. You put in the public comments a number of links and some information, and I wanted to give you a chance to clarify what your thoughts were there.
Sure. So I am still here, and most of my links were, I think, actually explained well by some of Arian's history earlier in the call. I linked a couple of things that came up about policy questions in terms of the current policy, both what is required by certification to be made accessible to patients from an electronic health record, which included both the diagnostic test reports as well as a series of information about lab test results, which is kind of pertinent to some of our questions today, and then also the current lab standards that are included in certification, though as we discussed, some of them were in previous phases of certification and no longer listed.
I'm curious, this notion that standards have been dropped from the certification, while I appreciate the idea of trying to remove topped-out standards, you know, as a way of at least appearing to reduce burden for providers and health systems, et cetera, it seems odd to me that if we've identified a standard that is helpful, that is valuable, that we really want everyone to continue to comply with, that we would remove it in that way. I know many of the people on the call have been involved in this process. Do we feel that's a good thing, continuing to remove topped-out standards and kind of leaving that the assumption that they're going to be continue to be followed, or does it make more sense to try to keep them in
the standards.
And again, this is
just
as
a much larger question about the sort of value of standards and the value of certification. So I think we should have separate conversations about each of those. The standards themselves are not removed or not used. They're still identified within the interoperability standards advisory, as we saw earlier on today's call. I guess the question is there enough value to merit third-party conformance testing of each of those standards of all current systems in use, or at least EHR systems? The certification process never actually covered the lab end of the interoperability. And so I guess there is a larger debate there to say what things are worth paying a third party to test specifically in terms of assuring that we get the outcomes that we want. And where is it worth being judicious with our spending to say, no, we don't need a third-party verification of that particular item? But I don't think that's something we can resolve in the next 4 minutes. I think that's a whole discussion in and of itself.
And just a quick history lesson here, the way this came about is that there were originally certification criteria that weren't tied to meaningful use criteria, and I think there was an appropriate decision that that was sort of onerous on the EHR developers. So there was a policy decision to tightly align meaningful use criteria with the associated certification criteria. And then as a subconsequence of that, when we started removing top-down measures that were fully achieved on the implementation side, we ended up, as a consequence, removing the associated certification criteria. So just so people understand how that came about.
Could I just – there was a dispute as to whether the data saying it's top-down was right. I think they had like an 8% response in the topped out things, and I know that LabCorp sent a formal dispute, or at least disagreement with it, that they shouldn't have removed it, and it really hadn't topped out. And that's what we're talking about today. Everybody's not getting this stuff.
Actually, Clem, I think there are two separate questions. One is whether the meaningful use measure had exceeded the level CMS considered topped out. And I don't have the background on sort of what that level was or how CMS responded to LabCorp's dispute. But the other question is whether it makes sense for the certification standards to remain required for both electronic health records developers as well as purchasers of electronic health records to sort of have, given CMS's decision to remove the measure as being topped out. And each of those are interrelated, but they're somewhat separate questions.
I agree. Life is complicated.
I think Andy Truscott has a question.
Hey, not so much a question, more a comment. Thanks, Steve. In response to an earlier point that I think was very well made around, you know, there is a very good clinical care reason why we don't allow patients just to have lab results, you know, when they're released from the lab. Isn't there some kind of policy influence that we could ask to be brought to bear so that providers are able to make a pre-release decision? But there are a large number of lab tests which are non-contentious that they would be released to a patient early. I fully admit that there are some which would not be appropriate. So can a provider not be encouraged to make that determination when they submit the order so that actually that pre-release could happen in a large number of cases?
Essentially allowing a provider to specify a withhold on an order, making it more of an opt-out than an opt-in.
Either way, because some states will want it one way, some states will want it the other.
But is that necessary? This is Cynthia. Is that necessarily the case? I mean, you look at the examples of, you know, I can count on my right hand a couple of people that have had Lyme disease that never got their results of testing positive when the provider just didn't read the results, and then they got into chronic situation versus acute. So I just throw this out to say, who are we to judge rather than or set up hurdles further for the patient when, as Clem said earlier, you know, with Apple's current mobile ability, patients have the right to their information, and putting obstacles to withhold it, in fact, I don't believe is the job of our task force.
But that's the counterpoint to that, is Cynthia. We're actually saying we're trying to remove the obstacles, because right now the obstacles are there.
Well, thank you for those final comments. We are at the end of our time, and we want to respect everyone's time. This has been very helpful. I think that what we're going to do between now and the next meeting is perhaps have some offline meetings with the presenters, try to pull together all of the great input that was provided in the spreadsheet, and come back with a set of specific recommendations for the task force to consider. If people have additional input that they'd like to add to the spreadsheet, you know, feel free to do that over the next few days, and then we'll try to summarize all of that back to the task force at our next meeting. Thank you all for your time, and we will see you next time.
Thanks all.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.